the safety in aesthetics is certainly a massive problem. And last year, unfortunately, there was a death due to aesthetics from a lay practitioner.
Dr. Jessica Halliley is an award-winning aesthetics practitioner who is medically trained with years of experience. In today's episode, we discuss if all non-invasive procedures should be administered by medical professionals.
If you're having Botox with them, even a nurse that isn't a prescriber, they need to have arranged a face-to-face, in-person consultation with a prescriber for you to have Botox prior to having it.
We also discussed the different career pathways you can take to become an aesthetics practitioner.
I think within the aesthetic industry, there's probably two branches, general aesthetic practitioners and then aesthetic practitioners who are from a healthcare background or have those qualifications.
We discussed how Jess balances running a business with motherhood.
But speaking to mums and dads, I feel like mums are the ones that really struggle with the guilt, and that's why there's the term mum guilt. I don't think we hear the term dad guilt very often.
And so much more. And guys, the aesthetics industry is booming. I read an article recently which said the global market for non-invasive procedures for things such as Botox and lip fillers is set to top $78 billion by the end of 2027. And in today's episode, we give you all the information you need if you want to get into this industry. Now enjoy the show. Jess.
Hello.
Dr. Jess, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
No, absolute pleasure to have you back. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. Yeah, busy day today, but that's how I like it.
You know, that is how we like it. You're one of our few repeat guests. And to those who haven't seen the first episode, can you briefly take us on your journey up to this point?
So I am a GP.
General practitioner.
Yeah, GP, like you'd see in your normal kind of local surgery or practice. And I do still work in the NHS part-time, just doing one day a week now. And then the rest of my time is spent in my private practice. So I'm an aesthetics doctor. So I see my own patients for cosmetic procedures, non-surgical tweakments, as it were, and run my own clinic in Nottingham and also practice in Marylebone in London. And then I'm also an aesthetics trainer to people that are starting out in aesthetics or hoping to increase their skill set if they're already established. And I'm also a KOL, which is a key opinion leader for different brands within the aesthetic market as well. So I talk at conferences for them and do some international training with them too.
Wow.
And I'm a mum. I always
yeah. First and foremost.
That sounds really bad, but when I've got my business hat on, I list kind of credentials. But number one job, as any working mum knows, is still being a mum of my kids. So I've got two kids, and they are 5 and 7. So that's the hardest job of all.
Amazing. I love it. Thank you for that brief introduction. You kind of mentioned it there, but like, the aesthetics industry as a whole, to the listener who wants to understand more about it, could you just like give us a general summation? Like, yeah, I know about Botox, I know about lip filler, but I'm sure there's so much more to it. So yeah, how would you define the aesthetics industry?
I think it's absolutely enormous now. So it's a really big umbrella term, and different clinics may specialise in different sectors of that. But ultimately, it includes all non-surgical treatments, so injectables like Botox, fillers that everyone's aware of, skin boosters, new generation of skin bio remodelers, things like polynucleotides. Lots of people have heard about the salmon sperm injections.
Yeah, I've got a colleague at work who's done that.
Got a lot of kind of traction on social media recently. So there's all the injectable side, and then there's a really recently, I would say over the last 3-4 years, there's been a huge growth in regenerative medicine within aesthetics. So looking at energy-based devices, getting our skin to repair itself from within, inducing collagen in the skin rather than just treating the symptom, as it were. We're trying to do a lot of prevention as well and skin repair. And then, of course, you've got all the skin side, medical grade skincare, treatments like chemical peels, medical needling, all sorts of facial treatments you can have nowadays, lasers, etc. So it's a really, really broad field. And a lot of clinics and practitioners like myself are actually branching out into some surgical procedures as well. So things like face type, body type, that can be done within a clinic setting, not under general anaesthetics.
What is a face type? What is a body type? Because one of my questions was going to be, is it all face? But you've just answered the question. Well, you're nodding yes, but I thought body type, that doesn't sound like face.
No, so it's not, the aesthetic industry is definitely not just face anymore. There's lots of treatments we can do all over the body. So I do a lot of skin tightening treatments, for example, on abdominal laxity, upper arm laxity. I do Pure Impact, which is the new generation of EMS, which is electrical muscle stimulation. Mm-hmm. So people that are wanting
to give people abs.
Things like that. So people that are wanting to really kind of sculpt and define and contour. So yeah, it's a huge body treatment. But in answer to your question, face tight and body tight is essentially almost like a form of liposuction with some skin tightening thrown in. So some clinics do that. I don't offer it myself.
Bloody hell. I love it. I love it. You've really set the scene. And like, I spoke to you maybe like 18 months ago.
Yeah.
And when we had our first conversation, you mentioned the fact that, you know, for anybody who was looking to get into the world of aesthetics, you wouldn't advise they do it if they weren't like a doctor or medically trained, because it was in the process of becoming like quite regulated. Since our last conversation, like, how much advancement has there been? Because I've done some research, and I think the stat I saw, it's like up to 70% is like unregulated. So yeah, has there been any progress?
Short answer is no. No progress to regulation. I wouldn't say you definitely don't have to be a doctor to do aesthetics. Okay. Lots of incredible aesthetic nurses out there. But I think because the plan apparently is that the government is going to regulate the sector, it's just taking a lot longer than anyone anticipated. I think it might be tricky if you're starting out and you don't have any kind of healthcare qualification, because then you might end up being, you know, coming into difficulties when the regulation does come into play. So that was kind of my why I said that back then. But lots of doctors, dentists, nurses, pharmacists, etc. are doing it already. And I guess the difference is we're bound already by our statutory regulatory bodies. So like, doctors have the GMC, which is the General Medical Council, nurses have the NMC, so we're already regulated and have much stricter rules essentially that are governing our practice within aesthetics. Whereas people that aren't in those healthcare sectors and aren't responsible to a governing body don't have those same regulations on them, so their practice is not necessarily going to be as closely monitored, for example.
Yeah, and there's so much to go into. Like, when I was doing research for this episode, I saw like a crazy stat. It was like, in 2023, the global market for non-invasive procedures hit $45 billion, and by 2027 they expect the global market for non-invasive procedures to hit $78 billion. For an industry that is generating so much revenue, why is there such a lack of regulation?
I think you'd have to get someone from the government on here okay. to explain themselves. I mean, there's various theories. I mean, one, it's incredibly difficult to regulate because it's so established in the UK. And, you know, there are lots of practitioners who aren't medically qualified who are doing a great job. But there's also, and there's lots of, I'm sure out there, there's lots of kind of rogue medical practitioners that maybe aren't doing a great job. But the issue is, it's so saturated and there's so many non-medics doing it that how are we going to regulate them retrospectively now when they've established their life and their livelihood on it? I think that's an issue. And I also think there's a big issue because in terms of the government, they are earning a huge amount of money from the industry. All other countries almost in the world are regulated apart from the UK, and the government earns an incredible amount of money from of tax from it, because prescribers, for example, like myself, who are able to prescribe, because a lot of products are prescription only within aesthetics. For example, Botox, which not many people are aware of, it's a prescribed product specific to that patient. So prescriptions aren't, necessarily have to pay VAT on, for example. So the government are getting a huge bill from all the... Yeah, I think that's part of it,
And, like, I suppose the reason I was asking that question, like, in your opinion, what is the impact of the lack of regulation for consumers and people who are getting these procedures?
I think it can be hard for patients to make perhaps the right decision about who to go to see, because there's not any kind of governing body there. There's no qualification you have to have, so you can literally do, I mean, there's practitioners that just do an online course, or they'll do a 1-day course in Botox and fillers, and they'll start doing it from their bedroom the next day. It's completely completely unregulated, and I think that makes it hard for the consumer, one, because the market's so saturated, so there's a lot of choice, and they need to know kind of what to look out for to find a good practitioner, and two, I think it puts a lot of patients at risk. And I think the fact it's so readily available and a lot of people are doing it so low cost and using such poor quality products, and perhaps haven't had the best training or don't know how to manage the complications that invariably do occur, we're then ending up with patients suffering as a result. So I think, you know, the safety in aesthetics is certainly a massive problem. And last year, unfortunately, there was a death due to aesthetics from a lay practitioner. So really? That was that kind of hit the industry quite hard.
What does a lay practitioner mean? Somebody who's not qualified?
Not qualified, because it depends how you define qualified. Like, yeah, they might have done a course or whatever, but someone who's not from a medical background.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is so sad. Mm. So, like, I think that was, like, great scene setting. And I think, like, the reason I wanted to have this conversation today, right, because it is such a booming industry, and I'm sure there are so many aspiring aesthetic practitioners who do want to do it the right way. Mm. So, like, that brings us nicely, like, for the listener who is either, you know, in aesthetics looking to level up, or they're about to begin their aesthetics journey, like, what would your advice be to them, and like, what qualifications should they be seeking out?
So preferably to have a healthcare qualification, so for example a nursing degree, a medical degree, being a dentist.
Oh, like, go to uni. Oh, damn.
Yeah. Because that's kind of the gateway into medical aesthetics. Okay. So I think within the aesthetic industry, there's probably two branches, of general aesthetic practitioners, and then aesthetic practitioners who are from a healthcare background or have those qualifications. So, for example, doing something like that would be a great entry point. But if you're not going to go down that route, then certainly doing more advanced training in aesthetics. So, for example, the Level 7 diploma, which is equivalent to a master's degree, in aesthetic medicine, means that you get not just kind of those couple of days and then you're left on your own, you're getting a full mentorship program, and you're really able to kind of build exponentially on those skills.
Mm-hmm. I love that. So the two questions I had there, so you mentioned there's the general practitioner's degree, and what was the other one?
So not general practitioner, because that would be like a GP.
yeah sorry, you said the general general aesthetics.
No,
what was it you just said? I literally just heard you, and I was like, you said there were two types. Either you can do the general one or
So you've either got like the aesthetic practitioners that don't want to have a medical background.
Yeah.
So if it remains unregulated, then I'd still recommend that they do the level 7 if they want to enter into the field.
Okay. And then those with a medical background.
Ideally, you need to have a medical background. Okay, so that's what we're hoping the regulation will cover.
And I'm with you. And then my question was going to be, regardless of the route you take, will that impact the amount you can charge? Like, obviously, with the medical background, does that give you more credibility so you can charge like higher rates? I'm just thinking about it, if people are getting into it purely for money, because I know, like, speaking to you off camera, some people see it as a quick way to make money. Spoiler, it's not. Stop. Like, yeah, is it like, how does like charging vary based on your ability and qualifications?
That's a tricky question. Honestly, I don't think that the pricing structure necessarily is going to directly reflect that. Mm-hmm. I think it's what your patient base are willing to pay. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, personally, I price myself because of my credentials, and I know that my patient population, yes, they could go somewhere else for cheaper, and someone that's perhaps not a doctor, for example, and you know, but ultimately they're paying for the years I've done in training and my expertise and my complication management, and you know, the overall experience of my aftercare. So personally, I think it can help, but it's definitely not a dead cert, and pricing is really, really variable between practitioners and locations. Like my Nottingham clinic prices are different to my London clinic prices, course, so it just also course. Depends where you're based.
I love that. And then you mentioned that level 7, which is the equivalent of a master's.
Mm.
Can you just go straight into that? Like, do you need to have like a base level before like being admitted onto that?
No, within the level 7, well, there's different types. There's the level 7 certificate, which is a little bit more condensed, and there's the level 7 diploma, which is more lengthy. But usually they include, advanced training. So generally you would do your foundation training first,
mm-hmm.
In botulinum toxin, so Botox and dermal fillers, and then you'd progress through. But it generally just includes, Botox and fillers, and then you have to invest in further training to learn about other products, things like skin boosters, polynucleotides, energy-based devices, and skincare.
I love it. I think we would be remiss to not talk about, like, the cost of investing in yourself, because, you know, the first pathway we suggest is university, and everybody knows like the god awful fees. And yeah. From the first conversation, I remember the phrase, my student loan is colossal, guys. Yeah. Colossal.
It's still there. It hasn't shifted at all. It's just the same. Like I just pay off the interest. It's
yeah.
Sort of, I feel like it's always going to be there, but we'll see.
So yeah, on the one hand, you have all of the debt that you're going to accrue with a university degree, which it might be like 10k a term or a year for 2, 3, 4 years for your medical
yeah.
degree. On the other hand, you've got the different types of level 7 diplomas. I think from memory, like, is it like 10k for
yeah,
a level 7
about
diploma
that. yeah a good provider.
And then is it within the level 7 you do the foundation, or you do the foundation before the level 7?
It might vary between providers, but I think usually you would do the foundation first, which is probably about £1,500 to £2,000.
Okay, so yeah. On the one hand, I'm seeing here 30 to 40k, but obviously a lot of years of study.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I'm seeing actually years of study, but something in the range of £10,000 to £15,000. So yeah, just something for the aspiring practitioners to consider.
Yeah, absolutely. And you invest repeatedly as well. So the thing about aesthetic medicine is it's such a fast-moving field. There's new advancements all the time, new products coming out all the time. And you have to continually invest in yourself to learn them and to stay on top of the game.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I go on courses that I fund myself every single year. So that investment carries on, mm-hmm. certainly. And, you know, every course you do, every new product you bring into clinic, you're investing in a course to be able to offer that, or you should be anyway if you're with a good insurance provider.
I love that. And like, I had a guest on this podcast and he said something that has stuck with me from the moment he said it. He said the ROI on investing in yourself is infinite. So even though at the time these courses, they might seem like steep and put you out of pocket, the return on investment that you can get with like the procedures you're able to deliver to your customers, it truly is infinite, and it's going to open doors that you simply might not have been able to open before. So look at it as an investment in yourself and not as like a cost for a course. Am I right?
Yeah, I agree. All of that investment I've done into myself since starting in my aesthetics career has led me to this point. And even things that I invested in when I was just a general doctor and a general practitioner, things like I've always really enjoyed teaching, so I invested in a train to teach course and that kind of thing, and that's all fed into what I do now as well. So yeah, I agree with that. It's definitely scary when you're doing it,
yeah.
And you're thinking, oh my god, I've started this business 2 years ago and I've not made any money, when you calculate everything that you're putting into it. But if you want to make a success of it, ultimately you have to take that risk.
Yeah, I love it. And then like, as you were talking about like the different level sevens and the fact that you can get them from different providers,
mm-hmm.
at the start of the conversation you mentioned the fact that yeah, people can go online, they can do one course, they can, you know, get a certificate or whatever, and then they go about like administering treatments.
Yeah,
how is it that aspiring practitioners can make sure they're not getting scammed, essentially,
mm-hmm.
and that they're getting they're paying for courses from accredited bodies. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like what would your advice be to make sure they're getting them from the right providers?
It's tricky because, again, because the industry isn't regulated, you've got two different types of training providers. You've got the medical training providers, and then you've got the non-medical training providers. So the medical training providers only train medics. So like where I train, for example, at Acquisition Aesthetics, which is an award-winning academy in London.
Plug, plug.
Yeah. Trainer 10, use the code, 10% off. We only train doctors, dentists, nurses. So if you are from a medical background, you need to make sure you're going to one of these established training groups. There's things like Acquisition Aesthetics, Harley Academy is a big one, and they provide a really, really good service and a great mentoring team and support kind of throughout your early career rather than just that day. And it's tricky for the people that aren't medically trained because they can't access the trainers like myself who come from that background necessarily, because because again, you know, I'm not insured to train people that aren't medically trained, so things like that. The top insurers, so here in the UK for aesthetic industry, it's Hamilton Fraser and Cosmetic Insure. Again, you know, a lot of that they say to me, you can only do a course if it's been taught by a medical professional, otherwise you're not insured on that product. So just be careful with where you're going. If you are from a medical background, because you have to, because it's, you know, you're regulated by your governing body, you have different rules than people that aren't. Whereas people that aren't can literally go anywhere and you know, it might not be what I think is right, but legally they can do what they want.
Wow. And you've just mentioned like medical insurance there. Mm-hmm. Like, why do you need it? And like, how does that end up like working?
Well, you need insurance. Same as like as a GP, I have to have insurance, medical indemnity insurance for
if something goes wrong.
Yeah, of case of negligence or patient complaints, anything like that. Same in the aesthetics industry. Ultimately, they are medical procedures. So there's going to be patients that get complications and that's unavoidable. Mm-hmm. So making sure that you know you have appropriate cover and always ensuring that, you know, the patient's making an informed decision. So my consultation process is quite long. So even if something like they might have booked for something like lip filler that they see on social media all the time and they think it's really simple. And sometimes by the time I finish going through what that actually involves, what the potential risks are, the statistics, etc., you know, I'll have patients to say, actually, I don't want to have it. Mm. And I'm like, that's fine, because I'd rather you decided that on an informed decision with a proper consent process, and you know they have to sign those consent forms as well, that they understand the risks, because even in expert hands things do happen. It's very, very rare, but they do happen, and they need to be aware of that.
So then, like, the question I have to ask, all right, so as a medical professional, you're able to get the insurances you've mentioned. Mm-hmm. If you're not a medical professional, what insurances are available to those people?
There are insurances available, but they're just they're not considered to be that high quality. So the patient might not be as protected. So if they were to have a legitimate claim, for example, against a practitioner from perhaps not a particularly reputable insurance body, then, you know, their claim might not get very far.
Bloody hell. Yeah.
So you need to think about that as well when, you know, a lot of patients are choosing their practitioner by price, and that's my biggest advice. I think if you're being really limited by price, then maybe just not the time to have an aesthetic treatment, because it, you know, good quality aesthetic treatments are expensive. They're a luxury that, you know, certainly not everybody can afford. So I think the fact, you know, everyone's having them now just reflects that there's a lot of people paying a really low cost and ultimately probably getting quite poor product. Mm-hmm. I'm always shocked when, you know, I see adverts or see things on social media saying, you know, lip filler £75 or three areas of Botox for £100, because it's just not, that wouldn't even cover the cost of my product.
Wow.
So I just think, well, what on earth are they using?
Are they,
and do you want
face?
That being put in your face?
But it's not salmon sperm, it's tuna sperm.
It's goldfish.
Yeah.
So you have to think about that, but ultimately, you know, everyone's responsible for their own body, and if
how can you not be bothered about what you're injecting into your body, onto your face?
A lot of people clearly aren't, though, are they? Because that's why there's this massive market for cheap injectables.
But, you know, rather than saying they're not bothered, I think people are just desperate.
do you think?
Because I think sometimes, like, when you're desperate, you don't make... your decisions don't make sense, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, people are bothered, but they're so unhappy, maybe, with the way they actually look, mm-hmm. that they'd rather risk, like, having a positive outcome and, you know, taking the risks, then yeah. like, remain the way they are, which is like super sad.
Yeah, I think there's truth in that. There's probably a mixture of those that just, you know, aren't too concerned about it, and others that, yeah, like you say, are you know, desperate to have something done, but your result probably isn't going to be like what you imagine and what you see, you know, in celebrities and things, because it's a much lower cost option. But again, ultimately, it all goes down to the fact, that's why I believe in regulating the industry, and having much stricter rules about what products can be used as well.
Yeah, I love it. This is blowing my mind, by the way, because, yeah, to your point, I know so many people that have had, like, non-invasive procedures, mm-hmm. and just to, like, sometimes you see it as well and you're like, damn. And I remember you saying something in our first conversation, if you can see somebody has had work done, it means the work done is rubbish.
I do think that it sounds mean, doesn't it, but because of the way I market myself, the fact I specialize in natural results and a kind of holistic full face approach, I very rarely get patients coming in that want anything other than that. So they usually come in, they're really nervous, they've thought about it for such a long time, but they've seen my work and they've thought, yeah, okay, I think I can trust you. But they'll still say, I don't want to look down, I don't want anyone to look at my lips and think, oh my god, she's had lip filler. So then I always say, like, you know, I personally think if you can tell straight away from looking at someone in the street they've had filler, then they, you know, it's not the best filler, because actually filler when done well is actually really, really subtle, and it's just those kind of little tweaks that make the difference to kind of rejuvenate you and refresh you, so you still look like you, but you just feel like the best version of you.
This is just blowing my mind.
You need to come and see me. I'll book you in.
Whoa, what for? but yeah, no, we'll take that offline. all right, so, like, we've really, like, spoken about, you know, how people, like, aspiring practitioners can get into the industry.
Yeah.
We've spoken about the risks. We've spoken about the insurance. To, like, the customer, you know, we've highlighted some of the risks there. Mm-hmm. But, like, how is it you go about finding reputable practitioners? Because I know, like, you see online, there's so much before and after, 100k followers, but I know in actual fact, a lot of it is, it's a lie, right? So, yeah, what is your experience with false advertising or in the industry? Mm-hmm. And, yeah, how is it potential customers can go about making better informed decisions?
I would definitely look at the practitioner's credentials, their training background, rather. I think a lot of people, especially of our generation, well, probably more your generation because I'm a bit older than you, using social media as like a search engine, essentially, which is fine, and in a lot of sectors that works really well, but I think when there are increased risks and we're talking about injectables, or, you know, putting something like dermal filler in your face, which is going to be in your tissues long term, then you need to do a bit more research, because I see a lot of people, and I've treated a lot of patients who've come from other practitioners, and they, you know, they say, oh, they had 100,000 followers, or this, that, and the other, and their before and after pictures look really good, and then they've had quite, you know, a complication that could have been avoided, or something like that. So don't just go on social media. I think it's great because it's a good way for practitioners to showcase their work, for you to get to know them a little bit more. So, you know, I put a lot on my Instagram, and there are before and afters on there as well. But just always look at before and afters with a critical eye, because you do see a lot where it's literally just angle or lighting. So you can change that. And, like, the main one I always say is, like, to my patients, I'm like, okay, look, I've got a double chin and now I don't. Like, that's how easy it is to do a before and after. So you need to, if you're looking at them, make sure they're really good quality. So, like, you'll notice in mine the angles are exactly the same. The lighting's the same. Like, there's... you know, there's no tricks, it's just what's been done. So always look at that as well. Personally, I do advocate that patients seeking aesthetic treatment should go to a medical professional. I think it's safer because the industry isn't regulated as a whole, and products are certainly not regulated. Like I said already, Botox is a prescription only drug. Okay, so if you're seeing someone that isn't a prescriber, so prescribers are doctors, dentists, or nurse prescribers, so not all nurses, then they need to have arranged, if you're having Botox with them, even a nurse that isn't a prescriber, they need to have arranged a face-to-face, in-person consultation with a prescriber for you to have Botox prior to having it. So that happens, you know, very rarely when you're seeing a non-medical injector, because they're either getting Botox off of a rogue doctor, because I would lose my license if I did that, or they are getting it from somewhere else. So if they're getting it from somewhere that isn't a UK CQC registered pharmacy, then where are they getting it from? I get messages, emails, phone calls every single day from China, eBay, that's where the products are coming from. And I'm not saying that they're definitely counterfeit, but we can't track them. So I, you know, sometimes we do get the horror stories, and you're taking that risk if you go down that route. So that's why I say, for me, I advise that you should go to a medical practitioner, so you've got more peace of mind, and also they're more able to manage the complications. As a prescriber, if I need to dissolve filler, if there is an emergency complication, I can do that because I can hold Hyalase, which is the dissolving agent, to filler as stock, which is also a prescription only drug. Someone gets an infection, I can prescribe antibiotics. I can manage my own complications. Whereas if you go to someone that can't, they quite often will, you know, filter you out or go and see your GP or go to A&E. You can guarantee, I mean, they're lucky if they see me as a GP because I'll know what to do, but you can guarantee a GP if someone comes in and says, oh, I've got this kind of weird mottling and there's a blister there, and I had lip filler yesterday, and they said just to come and see you, then you're not going to have a clue, you know, when actually this could be a vascular occlusion, the artery could be blocked. If you don't dissolve and restore the blood flow quickly, then they're going to end up with irreversible scarring.
Oh my goodness. So,
you know, that's why I advocate for the medical approach. So in summary, after wattling on about that, credentials, take social media with a pinch of salt. Just use it to kind of support what you've already found out about the practitioner, because they usually have websites as well. If you want kind of a top person in the industry, then look at their other roles. So for example, are they a trainer of an established medical aesthetics academy, like myself, because obviously you need to have really good skills to be able to treat other medical practitioners. Do they have a KOL role? That's the key opinion leader roles I was telling you about, who, again, you kind of have to be near the top of your game to be able to, you know, present and teach internationally on different products and brands.
I mean, yeah, like, you're welcome, guys, because no, you need to make informed decisions. And like, as you was explaining that, like, all I could think is, people don't want to do the work. Like, we live in such a fast-paced society that people just want to see, oh, okay, they got loads of good ratings.
Yeah.
They got lots of followers. Bang. Good. And it's cheap. Mm-hmm. Oh, I must be
getting...
And
they're available tomorrow or next week.
Yeah.
Because I get a lot of messages like, do you have any appointments for XYZ this week? And I say, no, I generally have a 4 to 6 week wait, sometimes more for appointments, but sometimes a cancellation might come up. And, you know, if they're the patient that said you have an appointment this week, 9 times out of 10, I'll never hear from them again, because they're looking for like a quick fix. They've made a decision. They want it now. They don't care that much about, you know, whereas actually, like with anything, you know, any sector, if you want someone really good to do something for you that's at the top of their game, they're generally going to have a wait. And that's a good sign, I always think.
I'm not waiting 4 to 6 weeks, though, for my consultation.
We'll do yours later.
Oh, my God. Like, it makes so much sense. So, we've just spoken about how customers can, you know, find reputable practitioners. For a practitioner, how is it they go about building that trust with a potential customer base? Like, how is it, I know it's taken like years and years, but to anybody who's like, damn, like, I just can't seem to build a following, how is it you can go about building that loyal customer base?
I always reassure people that say that to me, who are in their first few years, like, first of all, don't worry, it does take time. I remember reaching out, messaging you know, people that I really respected around the kind of 18-month mark, and just being like, oh, I don't know what to do. Is it worth me carrying on? How, you know, how do I make this actually pay rather than me paying to do it? And they all said the same thing. They were like, you know, don't worry, you're still early on, it takes time. So I'd say that to all of my kind of, you know, people that haven't been in it very long, it just, you just need to just keep plugging away. Consistency is key. And in terms of building up your patient base, just do a really good job, because a lot of my patients certainly are word of mouth. And I think if you're trying to attract what I call the dream patient, the dream client, which is someone that really respects my credentials, they trust me, they want to have a long-term relationship with me. So they're not someone that's flipping between practitioners, looking for a deal, looking for what's on offer, and they'll go anywhere and everywhere. Then generally they really they respect, you know, if one of their friends or their auntie or their sisters had a really good experience, because then again that embeds that trust in them. So doing a really good job when you have someone is key, first of all. I always think spend good amount of time on your consultation, never selling to the patient, never putting pressure on them. I think that's really important, and that's helped me to establish such a long-term loyal patient base, not just getting new patients every month, but patient retention, which I think a lot of practitioners overlook. So
yeah, it's all about, if you've got a high churn rate, like leaky bucket, it's too much work. And even in my field, in like tech, we talk about the fact that customer acquisition, the cost of acquiring customers, whether it be through marketing or whatever, is very high. So yeah, retention is key. It's like 80% of businesses in tech. I don't know if it's similar for you, but
It is, and it's really important in terms of a financial business aspect, like you've said. And it's also important in terms of enjoyment. Like, I love my new patients and meeting them and knowing that I'm going to go on that journey with them. But it's also so nice to have patients that I see regularly, you know, a few times a year, or and you really get to know them, you get to know their history, their family, and it's nice to have that continuity of care. I guess doing a good job, building up your portfolio. So if you're really just starting out, then it's a good idea to offer, you know, some treatments at lower cost in return for the patient consenting for their images to be used for promotional purposes, so before and afters. Making sure that you don't get too obsessed with social media, because it's not everything. You need to think about things like Google My Business, SEO, etc. Because I think a lot of aesthetic practitioners, they'll put so much into their Instagram and then they don't even have a Google My Business, when actually, you know, a lot of people just Google Botox near me, the reality, and that's how they start looking into different practitioners. So that helps. Investing in yourself, networking is really, really helpful. That's something I've done a lot more of in the last few years. If you're at that point in your career where you've started to get, you know, a decent patient base, but you want to take the next step in terms of, you know, perhaps doing some speaking events at conferences and things, then networking within the industry is really important. And there's so many opportunities to do that. There's a lot of free conferences you can attend, a lot of free events, you know, from sponsors and pharma groups and things. So
I love it. And like you've touched upon it throughout the conversation, but to somebody who's listening to this, like, what is the actual step-by-step process for any procedure? Because you mentioned the fact that before you administer for any one of your patients, you do a consultation. What does the ideal end-to-end process look like for just any procedure?
So people can either book in directly just for a consultation, which is when we have, you know, a chat through everything, we talk about their concerns, what treatments may be of benefit to them. Sometimes my advice is not to do anything, because if someone doesn't need something, then I'm not going to tell them they do. And again, that's something that makes my patient retention rate really good, because they know that I'm not just financially motivated. And if they come
in... Do consultations cost money? Sorry to jump in.
Mine do, okay. Yeah. When I started out, they didn't, but mine do. It's low cost relative to kind of my time. So it's £50 for a consultation. So essentially, I ended up having to do that because lots of people don't turn up if something's completely free.
Yeah.
Yeah. But a lot of practitioners, when they're starting out, don't charge for consultations. It's a good way to get people through the door. You know, gratefully, I'm at a stage in my career where I don't have to do that now.
Your time is too valuable, which is like completely fine.
Yeah, so I still try and price it quite fairly so that it is accessible to patients, and it means that they can get dedicated time with me where we can really go through what the options are, really transparent about what the pricing would be for all of those options. And again, I want to establish a long-term relationship with patients. I don't want them to just come see me once and then disappear and then come back in 5 years. You know, if they're committed to kind of the journey of improving their skin or improving their well-being and improving their confidence, or the huge, like I was saying earlier, regenerative preventative side of aesthetic medicine, then, you know, I'm here to be on that journey with them, and I value them and they value me, and it's kind of two-way reciprocal respect and trust. So that's really nice.
You mentioned the fact that you want to build like long-term relationships with your customers.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think when I was doing my research again, I saw a trend that the client base is getting younger and younger.
Mm-hmm.
In your professional opinion, at what age should people start having like these non-invasive procedures? And have you also seen that trend of younger and younger people getting these procedures?
I haven't seen that trend personally in my clinic. Probably because of the price point, two, perhaps who my target patient is and who I market to. But you know, the statistics do show, like you said, that people are getting non-surgical treatments at younger ages. Mental. In terms of the right age, there's no right age. You need to find a good practitioner and have a consultation, because every face is different, so you can't give a kind of blanket answer about, oh, start having Botox when you're 30 or whatever, because, you know, the majority of my patients are 30 plus, with the biggest cohort of women in their 40s and 50s in my clinic. However, I do, you know, I do have a couple of patients who are in their early 20s that have Botox with me, and that is appropriate for them because they already have static lines, for example, which are lines that you can see on your face all the time, not just when you're expressing.
Wouldn't know.
You got no, you don't have any. You got a flawless face.
Yeah.
Whereas, for example, I'll consult with a patient, saw a patient last week who's 44 and had booked in for Botox, and actually she didn't need it at all. So we had that conversation. So there isn't a set age. It's really about the individual. So again, it's so important to find a practitioner whose ethos is about treating you ethically, not just because you booked in for Botox 3 areas. Just banging it in, because mm-hmm. we don't want to do that. I say no a lot.
Which is great.
Yeah.
That's responsible.
And my patients know me for that. And again, initially, you know, I remember like my husband was like, why are you saying no to all these people? Like, you've not made any money today. But again, it's about that long-term relationship of trust, because then that patient really believes in you, that you do really want the best for them, and they'll come back at a later date when perhaps it is appropriate or there's another concern that they want to discuss with you. So that's how a lot of my patient relationships have built long-term over time, because then you get that reputation, and you'll see kind of what, you know, a lot of my reviews will say like, there's no pressure, and she told me I didn't need XYZ, which was, you know, really refreshing.
That leads me nicely into like the myths about the industry, because I know, once again, speaking to you offline, people think it's like a quick money maker,
mm-hmm.
fast money. So yeah, can you talk to me about the myths within the aesthetics industry?
Yeah, I think it does have this this image of easy money, both from people entering it who are wanting to do it, and also from patients, actually, because sometimes I'll get a remark from a patient, you know, about, you know, Botox is a very quick procedure to do. We spend most of the time talking or consenting, and then you do the treatment, and they'll say, God, that was a quick 300 quid or whatever it was. That was a quick 300 quid for you. You know, that patient has not thought about the context to everything else that's gone into that. So it's definitely not quick money, and it's definitely not easy. So please remember that it's an incredibly rewarding career if you're willing to invest in it long term. But it certainly does not give you money quickly. I did relatively well out of it quite quickly, compared to a lot of people that enter into the business. But, you know, I've got amazing colleagues that have been doing it 4 or 5 years and they're only just turning a profit and they're really, really good at what they do.
Wow.
So yeah, the amount you have to invest into, you know, courses, insurance,
how much
quality products, etc. Insurance varies dramatically.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Depending on, but you know, it soon adds up.
Yeah, of course. No, I agree.
Everything you're paying out, obviously, if you have a clinic premise, it's extremely expensive to run. Any small business knows how expensive a venue is to run nowadays with bills and everything like that. And obviously, like you say, I think sometimes people forget the background investment you've done. You know, I did 6 years at medical school, 2 years foundation junior training. I did a further 3 years to become a GP, all of that. And
just,
you know,
casual 11 years there.
Exactly.
And I think, like, just on like your Botox comment of, oh yeah, that was a quick, you know, 300 quid. I think, yeah, to your point, one of the things you didn't mention there is like, it might have seemed like an easy procedure, but alongside the consultation, to your point, with every procedure there's risk, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, there are these unexpected, I forgot the term you used. Yeah, the unexpected,
yeah,
complications that do occur.
Mm-hmm.
So like, you're paying to minimize like that happening.
Yeah.
And it looks easy, but it's a bit like a surgeon, right? It
mm-hmm.
looks easy, but because you've been doing it for so many years, you're able to make it look easy, but there is so much that goes into it. So people
yeah.
really do need to understand that.
Yeah, I agree.
That brings me nicely, like, if I do say so myself, like, you're very accomplished, right? And you mentioned earlier, like, you're now seen as a key opinion leader.
Mm-hmm.
How does one become a key opinion leader? Because and this is like more targeted at people who are potentially in the industry
mm-hmm.
and yeah, trying to level up throughout the industry.
If you're in the industry, it's pretty much all medical, so you need to have that medical background, and you need to have quite a lot of experience. So I've been practicing for many years, have a really good ethos, specialize in natural results, have a really good speaking ability. So that's something I've improved on over the last few years. So I kind of, you know, snapped at any chance where I could do a speaking engagement, even if it wasn't paid, so that the right people would see me talking about a product or a brand or presenting about my case studies at different events. And that's what, you know, is what has gradually led me to getting the roles I've got. So you definitely need to be confident to train and to teach and to present, because there's, you know, there's loads of fantastic colleagues who are, you know, amazing at facial injectables, and that's what they're happy doing. And actually, the thought of getting in front of 200 doctors and nurses and dentists in an auditorium injecting live on stage, being recorded and speaking through it, is their worst nightmare.
Mm.
Whereas actually I really enjoy things like that. So
that's what you do.
That's part of what you do. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And,
depending
and
on what brand you're working with and what the opportunities are.
And yeah, I was going to say, like, as a KOL, like, what are the doors that are opened as a result?
Kudos within the industry is a big one, because it does come with an automatic respect, because you know, other practitioners know that. Sorry,
that's fine.
Other practitioners know that you're good at what you do, basically, and it opens doors to other opportunities. So once you get kind of your first KOL role, generally you then get offered more with different brands as well, because
and they're paid.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Why do I never talk about the finances of it? That's such a doctor thing to do. You've probably noticed that, like, I've not really
talked
about finances at all. And
I think
that's what's really strange as well. You know, for doctors like myself, who, and there's, you know, lots of us coming through now who are, you know, are doctors and have done a good job being a doctor, and then essentially you become a businesswoman by going into this new sector, which is very different to how we've always worked for the NHS, for example. And yeah, we're generally uncomfortable kind of talking or thinking about money, and yeah,
what,
it's a weird one.
Why?
I don't know. I think it's a very NHS mindset. Obviously, you know, whatever people think, some people think doctors get paid too much, but they don't in the NHS.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're used to just, well, I guess, going to work, working really hard and not getting that well rewarded for it.
Well, let's unpack it now. You've actually brought up, let's help you, let's help you to overcome that.
Yeah, because when you said, what do you get out of being a KOL, I didn't even think about that. But actually, money. Yeah, the money is great. The money is really well paid. And yeah, it's
how often
fantastic.
Do you do KOL-based work? Is it like one day a week? Is it like every now and then, because it's like a talk at a conference?
Yeah, it varies, and it will go in waves. So, you know, you might do a few speaking engagements 1 month and then not do any for a couple of months. So it's up and down. It certainly couldn't be your fixed income. But
how much can you earn for a speaking engagement? Because people need to know that they should aspire to become a KOL if you're in the industry.
It does vary. So, for example, you know, certainly as a minimum, you know, at least £1,000 a day. But often at kind of bigger speaking engagements, you like that, don't you?
Yeah.
At bigger speaking engagements, like an international conference, you know, you can expect much more than that. And the bigger you get in the industry, the more your fee goes up. So
just minimum four figures, potentially like five figures. Wow. I've just assumed that.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's amazing. Okay, so we've started to talk about like finances. For those who listen to episode one, we'll just briefly touch on it again. Like, Jess is a portfolio doctor.
Yes.
So you do one day as a GP,
mm-hmm.
and then you do 4 days in your private practice. Just so we can like set the scene, in your one day a week as a GP, like, what does that net out at roughly? And like, how many years have you been doing it? Because this isn't what you would enter on.
Yeah, so I'm a salaried GP, which means that you're employed by a practice, by the partnership within that practice, and you have a set salary, and the fees for that are pretty static across the whole of the UK. London will be slightly more, but generally across the UK, it's between 10,000 and I mean, depending on your experience, 12,000 per session. So one full day is two sessions.
Wait. One full day is two sessions.
Yeah, so say you work one day a week,
yeah.
like me, depending on your experience. So that's two sessions. So say you earn the lower end that, I mean, I don't think anyone would earn less than this per session, of 10K per session. So you're earning 20 grand a year. If you work, because I work one day a week, which is 20% of full time, because we work long hours. A full time GP would work 4 days a week. Okay. Yeah. So a full time salary GP usually earns about 80K.
Okay.
But can earn a bit more depending on their experience or if they're London based, etc.
Okay. So if I just do like some very quick maths, if you're earning 20 grand a year roughly for one day a week,
mm-hmm.
it's going to be, let's say there's 50 weeks in a year. £500.
That's 52, babe.
I know, but I'm just doing very quick maths. Right, hold on. £500 would be 25K. Let's say it's like just under £500 a day, mm-hmm. which is like not terrible. All right, so that's like what you'd earn as a GP.
Mm-hmm.
In your private practice, as a top aesthetics practitioner, like, what is the range you can expect to earn on, like a daily, weekly, and give a range, you'd have to talk about yourself.
Yeah, I mean, there definitely is a huge range, and there's names in the industry who have an extremely high price point that I'm not at that price point personally, and again, it varies on your demographic and your location. If you've got, you know, a clinic on Kensington High Street, you're going to have a certain demographic coming to you that can pay a certain amount. So there's definitely lots of really experienced medical practitioners that are earning 10 grand a day, if not more, but it just depends. I personally definitely don't earn that.
Okay.
Maybe one day, but I definitely earn more from my private work daily than I do from GP. Okay. So,
do the maths. More than £500 a day.
Yeah, definitely. So it doesn't make sense for me financially to be a GP anymore, but I just really enjoy it, and still keeping my skill set up and having that variety in the week I like. So that's why I continue to do it.
You mentioned that, like you like having that variety, mm-hmm. In the week. Yeah, like what else is it that motivates you to do everything that you do?
Well, I mean, I went into medicine primarily because, you know, as a young person, when I was choosing what I wanted to do with my life, I did want to help people. And actually, I was really passionate about mental health and I wanted to be a psychiatrist. That was my motivation for going into medicine in the first place, because of some personal experience of a family member of mine. So I thought, yeah, that's what I'd like to do. And I did actually get into... postgraduately, I got into psychiatry training and I just decided it wasn't for me and that I preferred general practice instead, because I liked the variety, the fact every patient you see is very different and you never know what's going to come through the door. So I ended up doing general practice instead, but I do enjoy that kind of public service aspect, I guess, and that's why, even though lots of people say like, why are you still bothering doing GP, but it's because I still feel that connection to the NHS. I believe in it, and I enjoy it. So I'll keep doing it for as long as I can.
Jez, this has been such a great conversation. Like, you know, we've mentioned the fact that you do one day a week as a doctor, 4 days a week in a private practice. You mentioned, like, earlier in the conversation, the fact that, you know, it's a small business, right?
Mm-hmm.
You are... you're a boss ass bitch.
Oh, I try. Plays.
Yeah, but like, what is it like being a businesswoman? And yeah, like, how is it you took the leap of faith into starting your own small business?
I think for me, it just kind of happened. I'm very driven as a person, and I almost have like slightly pathological desire to always be progressing. So I'm always looking at, okay, you know, if I have any spare time, I'm constantly thinking, what can I do? What can I learn? So for me, I was just trying my best, plowing everything into it. And the business just kind of evolved around me because the patient population got bigger and bigger. And now I'm in a situation where I'm like, oh my God, I am a businesswoman and I do own my own clinic. And it just kind of happened. And now I'm having to learn how to be a businesswoman. It wasn't the other way around.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of aesthetic doctors, that happens to them as well. So I'm definitely still doing a lot of learning on my feet. And
What is it you're doing to learn to become more of a businesswoman?
I guess things like, you know, marketing strategies, that the kind of the bigger picture, again, patient retention that we were talking about earlier.
Are you learning on YouTube? Is it books? Is it talking to other people in the industry?
I'd say more talking to others in the industry, some mentoring from people that have been doing it a lot longer than me. Outsourcing certain things as well is helpful. You know, I made my own website on Wix when I started, and I'm only now just getting an actual seasoned professional to do my website, because actually it has been fit for purpose for a long time, but now it's not. And you know, it's kind of, you can't do everything, you have to outsource things. So
it's finding investment.
Yeah, exactly, investing in the right people that can help your business and your brand to grow.
I love it. And then, like, you know, you're a woman, you're a businesswoman, you're a doctor, but first and foremost, you're a mother.
Yes,
right?
So absolutely,
how is it you're able to juggle and wear so many hats? And I'm sure there are going to be people who maybe want to get into aesthetics, but you know, maybe they're worried about slipping, you know, on the motherhood side. Like, what would your advice be to them? And yeah, how is it you juggle everything?
I get asked that question a lot, and my answer is I don't feel like I juggle it well. I feel on like very stressed a lot of the time. It's not like I think, oh, I've got it all sorted, I have all these hats on and I'm a wonderful mother. Like, I feel very stressed and sometimes like on the verge of a breakdown. I think women don't talk about that enough.
Yeah,
like, they just
yeah.
paddle on. Like, I'm like one of those, you know, those like ducks and everything looks fine, and underneath I'm like, oh my God, I can't cope with this. And I think a lot of working mums who, you know, have multiple jobs or run their own business feel the same way. So I definitely don't feel like I've got it all sorted. But I think being open about that and talking to others within your industry or your remit is really helpful, because I know so many of my colleagues who are really good friends of mine feel the exact same way. And we can kind of support each other, because you'll have weeks where you don't see your kids enough because you've had to go to a conference abroad and present or whatever has happened. Everything always seems to happen in one chunk. And then you'll have weeks where you feel like, I've really nailed this motherhood thing. I've managed to do all the school drop-offs and I've taken them to all their clubs or whatever it is. So it varies. And I think just being accepting of that, a little bit more forgiving of yourself as a mum is good for that, because we have like this innate mum guilt. So my other half's a police officer, so he works a lot of hours and shift work, etc. And like sometimes, you know, if he was on nights or late or whatever it was and he hadn't seen the kids for 3-4 days, like it doesn't really bother him. He's a great dad, by the way.
Great dad. Shout out.
But I don't think they have the same innate, I mean, obviously it's very generalised. I'm sure there are people that do. But speaking to mums and dads, I feel like mums are the ones that really struggle with the guilt. And that's why there's the term mum guilt. I don't think we hear the term dad guilt very often. And you know, if I haven't seen the kids for a couple of days, I'm really aware of it and I feel really bad. So one thing I have managed to do, which I think has really helped, is when I am with the kids, I really try, and I don't always succeed at this either, to be present with them. And by that I mean basically just chucking my phone somewhere else, because if I've got my phone with me, you know, I run my whole business from my phone, as I'm sure a lot of people do. Like all it takes is me to just look at an email, I'll suddenly get engrossed, you know, and the kids are playing or trying to get my attention, and then my mind's elsewhere. So if I kind of chuck my phone away and think, right, let's play a game, let's play a board game, or what do you want to do, get the dolls out, whatever it is, and just be focused on them, then I think even if that is for shorter periods than you would like, giving them that undivided attention and being present is really fulfilling for both of you. But you know, also coming from an NHS background, I actually see my kids more now than I did when I was a junior doctor working crazy hours all the time. So it also comes with, you know, having your own business comes with freedom to choose your own hours. So I work probably more now because I am running my own business as well as working. So that takes a lot of extra time in the evenings, but I'll work it around the kids. So like I'll take the kids to school, then I'll go to clinic, and then I'll pick the kids up, and then I might go back to clinic when Chris is home from work. So there's not much time for me, but I feel like they get a lot of quality time with me, which is nice. But yeah, it's really tricky, and I don't think there's a magic answer for it.
So what would you say the biggest challenge has been with balancing motherhood and business?
The time. There's only so much time in the day. Yeah. And I think using all your time on those two things and then having no time for yourself. Okay. So, yeah, I probably get like 20 minutes at the end of the day. Once I've done all the admin I need to do, once the kids are in bed.
For your glass of wine.
Yeah, for my bottle of wine. So yeah, I think probably time is, I mean, it's the limiting factor. Time, mum guilt, societal pressures that we're meant to be able to have it all, yeah, as women. I think it's great that obviously things have progressed from what they were like, and that now we have the option to have all these different things, but I think it's pretty impossible to feel like you can have it all.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah.
And not have a breakdown. That's the key.
I love that. But as you've just like spoken there, you know, you mentioned the fact that there isn't a lot of time for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's another thing that resonates with a lot of business women and mothers.
Mm-hmm.
How is it you do go about finding a little bit of you time to make sure you don't completely lose it?
Yeah. I definitely haven't succeeded in that one yet. And it's tricky because I was talking to someone recently, actually, who's not in this sector, but a very successful businesswoman, and saying that, you know, that I have, you know, my self-care goes out the window. I had a really successful kind of 6 months in clinic last year, a lot of speaking engagements. I was traveling a lot. And then I, you know, when I wasn't doing that, I wanted to be with the kids. Like I didn't go to the gym for 6 months. And some people are able to do it all, and I'm just not, you know, something has to give with me when I'm burning out. And unfortunately, it's usually stuff for me first. So it's definitely now we're in the new year, it's my New Year's resolution to be more rigid about that and block out self-care time, because otherwise, you know, I should prioritize it and I should see it as important as a meeting with so-and-so or, you know, taking the kids to swimming, whatever it is. And if I kind of block it out in my diary and my schedule, then hopefully I'm going to be able to stick to it more. But yeah, I haven't got that bit down yet. But I think the businesswoman I was talking about, she was saying, yeah, there's this whole thing like you can have it all, but you can't. She was saying, like, if you're on in a period of massive growth, like that's what that does take over and you kind of have to let it. But I mean, it's a bit of a debate there, it's a bit of a balance, isn't it? But I feel like I've been in that period for a couple of years, where, you know, I have made a lot of sacrifices, and this year I do plan on being much more regimented, and I feel like I'm at that point in my career where I can say no to things, like I can say no to engagements and I know that they'll offer them to me again. Whereas when that's happening for the first time, you have to say yes to everything, because if you don't, they'll go to someone else. So yeah, I think I'm just coming out of that spa day.
I love that. And I was listening to a podcast recently with a woman called Lara Acosta. And she mentioned the fact that like work-life balance is like a bit of a myth. And yeah, she spoke about the fact that you have seasons, and sometimes there are just seasons where you have to work really hard. And then there are seasons where you get a bit of time to rest. So yeah, I think, you know, to the businesswoman, I mean, I can't talk for you lot, but like, yeah, if you feel maybe a bit guilty, sometimes there are just seasons, from what I've heard from different, you know, speaking to different leaders, and it's okay to be busy. There will come a time, or you need to make the time, like you're saying, for yourself, and that time will come. It's just about, yeah, what is the priority to you at that moment in time.
Next time I come, I might have a six pack.
I love it.
I like Chinese and a bottle of wine too much for that.
Jess, this has been such an insightful conversation. Like, as we wrap up, to the person who's listened to this and is like, you know what, I wasn't quite sure if this was something I wanted to get into, but now I think, you know, this has given me all of the information I need to, you know, pursue a career in aesthetics. Like, what would your key piece of advice be for them?
I'd say get going and do it. I think a lot of people are put off by the fact the market is so saturated now, so they feel like they're never going to succeed. But as you said, with the statistics you were giving, the aesthetic industry is just growing and growing. So I think there is enough business for everybody. And that's also why I'm always about kind of collaborating with other practitioners in the area rather than trying to compete with them, because there's enough business for all of us. So if you're thinking about it and you think, yeah, actually this is for me, I think I'd be able to make a success of this, then I would do your foundation training and see what you think of it, or perhaps approach a practitioner and say, you know, would you mind if I kind of shadowed you in clinic or whatever it is, to see if actually it is something that they might enjoy day to day. But yeah, just believe in yourself, work hard, and great things can happen.
I love it. Jess, we do, you know that you've done this before. We've got a quick fire round. Are you ready?
Oh gosh, yeah, I'm ready.
Okay, here we go. Only Botox or only fillers forever?
Only Botox.
Would you rather deal with a patient with unrealistic expectations or an extremely anxious patient?
Oh, extremely anxious.
Would you rather deal with, actually, what's better, a patient ignoring aftercare or constantly calling with concerns?
Well, that's a tricky one. I think ignoring would be worse.
Okay. Medical conferences or business networking events?
Medical conferences.
What is your favourite non-invasive procedure?
My favourite is Softwave, which is an energy-based device that uses ultrasound to lift and tighten any skin on the face and the body.
And are there any aesthetics, KOLs people should be following?
Yes, there are. So some of the names, for example, I really respect in the industry. One of them is Dr. Sophie Schotter. She's fab. She's a great source of knowledge and really I kind of share the fact that she wants to educate her patients so they can make informed decisions. So I would definitely follow her. I'm also a KOL, so you can follow me too.
Love that.
At Your Beauty Doctor. So yeah, I'd say Sophie's a really good one to start with if you're just getting into looking at practitioners in the industry. She's based in London and Kent.
I love that. And then finally, like, who's your dream dinner guest?
It's got to be Beyonce.
Okay, had to be.
I think so. Do you know what though? I am a big Britney Spears fan.
Okay. It's so different.
I know. I grew up with Britney, and I feel like she'd be more fun at a dinner.
That's true.
Yeah.
Very, like, it'd be very unscripted.
I do love Britney. My 21st birthday party was Britney themed.
Was it?
Everyone came as a different Britney.
I was thinking, you're toxic.
Yeah.
And what did she?
I was the Circus Britney, which not many people know about. But if you're a real Britney fan, you'll know the Circus album. So it was like the whole top hat thing, and then all the boys were clowns. Yeah. But there was all the different Britneys, lots of bald Britneys. My friend Stephen did a really good Britney, where he was the, is it, which is the one with the snake? She has the snake round her neck. You probably don't know her that well. No, it's not that one. Anyway, he had a toy snake round his neck.
Slay.
Yeah, that one's really good. And a little mic that he'd made. So maybe I'll do it for my 40th. Okay. I'll invite you.
This was supposed to be quick fire, but this is the longest quick fire I've ever done. But just know, we've gotten to the end of our second conversation. Like, for those who want to learn more, where can they find you?
So Instagram's probably the best way to connect with me, at yourbeautydoctor_. I do also have a LinkedIn as well, Dr. Jessica Halliley. So yeah, those are two of the best ways to get in contact with me. If you want to just know more about me or my services, then you can look at my website, which is yourbeautydoctor.co.uk.
Yeah, I'm gonna work on a code, because at £300 for Botox, you should be able to give me a little 10%. You know what I mean? Give me a little £30. I need to pay for these lights.
You don't need Botox, so you won't have it.
No, I'm joking. Jess, this has been such an amazing conversation. And to the listener, if you've gotten to this point,
you know, well done for getting to this point. Yeah.
Make sure to like, subscribe, share. And also to any business women who listen to this conversation, I want to say, drop us a comment. Let us know how you do it. Like, are you able to do it all? Like, what advice do you have for other, you know, leaders, women, mothers? Please let us know in the comments. And with that, this has been another episode of What My Best Friend Does. If you didn't know, now you know. Now go outside and take some immediate action. Over and out.